Today is Monday, January 17th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Carol Van Dam in Washington. North Korea fires two more missiles.
The recent actions of North Korea, including repeated launches of ballistic missiles in the past, are a threat to the peace and security of Japan and the region.
U.S.-Russia talks continue behind the scenes.
We're engaged in brinkmanship at this point. I think each side is looking to see whether the other side is, as we used to say, is going to blink.
And explosions kill three people in Abu Dhabi. We'll have these stories and more next. Officials say three people were killed in a suspected drone attack that set off an explosion and fire in Abu Dhabi on Monday as Yemen's rebels announced military operations in the United Arab Emirates. Two Indians and a Pakistani died when three oil tankers exploded near an oil company's storage facility. Around the same time, a fire started in a construction area at Abu Dhabi Airport. Tobias Soltfeldt is a principal Middle East and North Africa analyst at the risk intelligence company Verisk Maplecroft in Edinburgh, Scotland.
The Yemen-based Houthis have claimed responsibility for the attack, but at the same time, it's a very complicated regional picture at the moment. It's also likely that suspicion is going to fall on Iraq-based groups who have recently made threats to carry out attacks against the UAE. It's only a few days ago that we saw some of the Iran-backed groups in Iraq threaten to strike against Abu Dhabi in response to what they see as Emirati efforts to interfere in Iraqi politics.
That is Tobias Soltvedt, an analyst at the Scottish risk intelligence firm Verisk Maplecroft. Police said small flying objects were found at both places, indicating the kind of attack that is normally unheard of in the UAE, a renowned safe haven in the Middle East. Iran-backed Houthi rebels in Yemen did not claim responsibility for the attack, but the Houthi spokesperson announced a military operation in the UAE. South Korea's military reported that North Korea has fired two suspected short-range ballistic missiles on Monday from an airport in its capital city of Pyongyang. It's the fourth test in 2 weeks of its expanding missile arsenal. Reuters correspondent Jason Albano has this report.
North Korea fired two suspected short-range ballistic missiles on Monday from an airport in its capital, Pyongyang, according to South Korea's military. It's the fourth test in less than 2 weeks, an unusually rapid series of launches as the country demonstrates its expanding missile arsenal. South Korea's unification ministry urged North Korea to choose peace over its missiles. Japan also reported the launch. Its defense minister saying the missiles appeared to have landed in the ocean near North Korea's east coast. Chief Cabinet Secretary Hirokazu Matsuno condemned the incident as a threat to peace and security.
The recent actions of North Korea, including repeated launches of ballistic missiles in the past, are a threat to the peace and security of Japan and the region, as well as the international community. We strongly condemn those actions.
Two of Pyongyang's recent launches involved hypersonic missiles capable of high speed and maneuvering after takeoff. A test on Friday involved two short-range ballistic missiles fired from train cars. These appeared to be designed to evade missile defenses. The North also vowed to pursue tactical nuclear weapons, which could allow it to deploy nuclear warheads on those missiles. U.S. President Joe Biden's administration imposed its first new sanctions on Pyongyang on Wednesday. It also repeated calls for North Korea to return to denuclearization talks, but Pyongyang defended the tests as its right to self-defense. It added on Friday that Washington was still engrossed in its policy of what it called isolating and stifling North Korea.
That was Reuters correspondent Jason Albano. The U.S. Special Envoy for the Horn of Africa heads to Saudi Arabia, Sudan, and Ethiopia on Monday amid ongoing crises in the two African nations. David Satterfield and Assistant Secretary of State Molly Fee are traveling to Riyadh, Khartoum, and Addis Ababa Monday through Wednesday. The two diplomats will meet in Riyadh with the Friends of Sudan, a group calling for the restoration of the country's transitional government after a military coup in October. A State Department statement said the meetings aim to marshal international support for the UN mission to facilitate a renewed civilian-led transition to democracy in Sudan. Little, if any, progress was made during a week of diplomacy prompted by Russia's massing of 100,000 troops along Ukraine's border. Most analysts did not expect any breakthroughs. Thomas Graham, a Russian expert with the Council on Foreign Relations, says the talks were the opening salvo in diplomatic efforts that will continue. But Graham says if Russian President Vladimir Putin is not able to get a written commitment from the U.S. and its allies saying NATO will never expand, Putin may consider other options, like expanding Russia's sphere of influence closer to U.S. soil.
We're engaged in brinkmanship at this point. I think each side is looking to see whether the other side is, as we used to say, is going to blink first. But as we face ever more squarely the possibility of a war in Europe, I think others, officials in Brussels and Washington and Moscow, we'll look at their negotiating positions, see whether there's some flexibility, and see whether there's a possible compromise that will diffuse the situation and still meet the minimal security needs of all sides. So I don't rule that out. We're just in a very sort of delicate position in a what is a negotiating situation.
So you still believe there is some sort of chance at compromise that can be worked out and possibly in the next few days while these talks are still ongoing? They are still ongoing, right?
Well, they're still, I'm sure we're still talking to one another in various channels. I'm not saying that we're going to see a break in this in the next day, but I think it was unrealistic to believe that you would have a break in the first week of negotiations. The first week of negotiations were really about laying out clearly what the positions of each side were, making sure the other side understood clearly what they were. I think they've accomplished that. Everyone is going back to capitals now and reassessing where things stand, and they will modify their negotiating tactics based on where they think the situation is, where there might be some flexibility, where they can make some progress. So I don't think diplomacy is over by any stretch of the imagination at this point. We need to give it some time.
Sometimes I just can't help but feel there's this machoism involved with leaders. And how much are they playing to their home audience when they talk tough, especially now, like you say, the beginnings of the negotiations, and they want to appear strong at home, right?
Well, no one wants to appear weak in a negotiating position. I think that's clear. So, yes, they do want to appear strong. They do want to appear strong before a domestic audience, but they also want to appear strong on the international stage to demonstrate that they are determined to push forward on the issues that they think are critical to them. So none of this is out of the ordinary. You know, we went through periods like this during the Cold War. As an initial set of negotiations, this was about as best as you could expect. There are tough issues, sensitive issues, and it will take some time to see whether diplomacy is actually going to work out.
If you had to, if you were pressed to put a time frame on this for reaching some kind of compromise, what would you say?
The question is not a time frame on reaching a compromise. The question is whether the two sides will believe that they are now engaged in a viable diplomatic track that will eventually lead to resolution of the outstanding issues. My sense is that we probably have a few weeks before we can make a final determination on that. And that's what the next couple of weeks are going to be about, to see whether we can find a way to launch sustained negotiations on very sensitive issues that concern the security of Russia, Europe, and the United States.
What about some of the ramped up threats that have been going back and forth? You're talking about gas exports and how Russia supplies much of Europe. We're heading into the cold weather. We are in the cold weather season, really. And I'm just wondering, do you think that Russia will play that card if things don't go to their satisfaction and stop, you know, exporting gas to, you know, the countries that very much depend on Russia for their, you know, gas energy imports, I should say?
Certainly that's a card that Russia is holding in reserve at this point. And they may play to some extent. And I do believe that they think that they have more of a reserve at this point. Russia is dependent on gas imports for a substantial part of its GDP at this point, so they don't want to eliminate those entirely. But given their macroeconomic situation, their very large international reserves and so forth, I believe they feel they have a cushion that perhaps Western countries don't when it comes to gas shortages in the winter. So, yes, that card is there. I don't think that the Russians want to play that immediately, but there may come a point when they believe that that is an appropriate card to play, and again, to force the types of negotiations that they're looking for.
That was Thomas Graham, a Russian expert with the U.S. think tank Council on Foreign Relations. He was speaking with me late last week. New Zealand and Australia have sent military surveillance flights to Tonga to assess the damage left by a huge undersea volcanic eruption in the Pacific Island nation. AP correspondent Charles de Ledesma reports.
A towering ash cloud since Saturday's eruption has prevented earlier flights. New Zealand hopes to send essential supplies, including much-needed drinking water. But communications with Tonga remain extremely limited. The company that owns the single underwater fiber optic cable that connects the island nation to the rest of the world says it's likely it was severed in the eruption, and repairs could take weeks. Tsunami waves of around 2.7 feet high had crashed into Tonga's shoreline. No casualties have been reported so far, although there are concerns about people on smaller islands. I'm Charles de Ledesma.
COVID-19 infections are soaring again at U.S. nursing homes due to the Omicron variant, and the death toll is climbing as well. New restrictions are being placed on family members who want to visit, and staff and residents are being pushed to get vaccinated if they haven't already. Nursing homes reported about 32,000 COVID cases among residents in the week ending January 9th. That's nearly a sevenfold increase from about a month ago. As cases surge in the U.S., U.S. President Joe Biden promises his administration will purchase 1 billion COVID-19 tests and make available free to Americans high-quality masks. VOA's Arish Arabasadi has more.
The U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, that's the CDC, recently released updated guidance for masks to protect against the COVID-19 disease. Seen here at the Protective Health Gear Production Facility in Paterson, New Jersey, is the N95, considered the premier respirator for protection against the infection.
The purpose of vaccines, the most important job of vaccines, is to save your life and keep you out of the hospital. And by that measure, these vaccines and boosters are working and working well. Now, you will hear, as many people have already heard, about people who have cases that are mild or asymptomatic, people who test positive despite being vaccinated or boosted. But keep in mind, what is often being prevented there is a more severe infection.
Murphy added that data shows strong efficacy for vaccination despite a roughly 20% chance for infection in those who are both vaccinated and have received a booster shot. The Biden administration has faced criticism for not acquiring enough masks and tests as Omicron spreads through the country.
When Omicron came, it created an extraordinary increase in demand. It's why the U.S., the U.K., and other countries found themselves without as much testing as they needed. But we are pulling out the stops on testing.
Dr. Murphy says the administration oversaw an eightfold increase in testing between December and January. Critics say it's simply not enough.
We've ordered too few testing kits, so our testing capacity has continued to lag behind each wave. It's too little and too late, but noteworthy for the next wave. We've ordered too few and too little treatments, and we don't have yet a global distribution and delivery plan for vaccines, so there's a lot that we can work on.
Former Trump Homeland Security Advisor Bossert adds that pandemic-weary Americans must remain vigilant.
Americans that are frustrated and giving up, I think they need to hear that a return to some rigor in our social distancing is necessary, because our hospital beds, and more importantly, our hospital ICU beds, are filling up and in some states are completely full.
The World Health Organization recently reported 15 million new COVID-19 cases in 1 week, a 55% jump from earlier figures. The U.S. alone accounts for nearly 800,000 new infections each day. The CDC has yet to recommend nationwide usage of the N95 mask, but the Washington Post reports the agency is considering updated guidance. Arash Arabasadi, VOA News.
A new assessment of the global labor market finds that recovery from the unemployment crisis created by the COVID pandemic will be fragile and will worsen inequalities between rich and poor countries. The projection comes in a new report from the United Nations International Labor Organization. Lisa Schlein has that story for VOA from Geneva.
ILO economists say labor markets are recovering from the pandemic-induced crisis much more slowly than previously expected. They project the number of global working hours this year will be 1.8% below the numbers of pre-pandemic hours worked in the last quarter of 2019. That deficit, they say, is equivalent to a loss of 52 million full-time jobs, twice as large as the number predicted in last year's global market survey. ILO Director General Guy Ryder says this shortfall in the labor supply comes on top of persistently high pre-crisis levels of unemployment.
In 2022, we project that global unemployment will stand at 207 million. And that's 20 million above the pre-pandemic level in 2019. Put in percentage terms, we expect the 2022 unemployment rate to be 5.9%.
The report finds a great divergence in recovery between regions. It says the European and North American regions are showing encouraging signs of recovery. The worst affected regions are Southeast Asia, Latin America, and the Caribbean. Ryder says the richer countries are expected to emerge from this crisis in better shape than the poorer countries. He says a big gap exists between the labor market prospects of countries depending on their level of income and development.
Many low and middle income economies are struggling to get back to pre-pandemic levels of employment and of job quality. And insufficient access to vaccines is putting pressure on their healthcare systems, with tight fiscal space limiting the ability of their governments to use stimulus measures to support their labor markets.
Ryder says the International Labor Organization has not taken a policy position on the legitimacy or otherwise of vaccination mandates in the workplace. He says the fundamental problem facing work sites is the unequal access to vaccines. For him, he says, the bottom line is to ensure that people are able to work in healthy, safe environments. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
You're listening to VOA News. Two teenagers have been arrested in England as part of the investigation into a hostage-taking incident at a synagogue in the U.S. state of Texas on Saturday. 44-year-old Briton Malik Faisal Akram from Blackburn was shot and killed after a 10-hour standoff with police near Fort Worth. Details of the ages or genders of the pair arrested in South Manchester on Sunday night were not disclosed. Greater Manchester Police said it was working with local communities and continuing to assist in the U.S. investigation. British authorities say the two teens were arrested as part of the ongoing investigation into the attack and were being held for questioning. AP correspondent Julie Walker reports authorities are still investigating a motive.
Malik Faisal Akram was killed after the four hostages at Congregation Beth Israel got out okay. The situation unfolded over 10 hours. President Biden on Sunday said the U.S. won't tolerate this.
This was an act of terror.
The FBI says it seems this was a lone act. On a live stream of the synagogue service, Akram could be heard demanding Afia Siddiqui's release from a Texas prison. She was convicted of trying to kill army officers. Biden says Akram may have just gotten to the U.S. recently and bought the gun off the street.
Whether he purchased from an individual in a homeless shelter or a homeless community, or whether because that's where he said he was.
I'm Julie Walker.
Chinese President Xi Jinping is calling for greater world cooperation in the fight against COVID-19 and pledged his country will send an additional 1 billion doses of vaccine to other countries. In a speech on Monday at a virtual gathering hosted by the World Economic Forum, the Chinese leader also urged other powers to discard what he called a Cold War mentality at a time of rising geopolitical tensions, an apparent swipe at the U.S. The Chinese president touted his country's efforts to share vaccines, fight climate change, and promote development at home and abroad. French teachers' unions on Monday called for another major strike this week to protest the government's COVID testing and isolation protocols. Teachers say the new rules severely disrupt classes. The move follows a one-day walkout last week that led to the closing of half of the country's primary schools. The teachers' unions accuse authorities of failing to establish clear rules that would keep as many students in school as possible. Palestinian residents of a flashpoint neighborhood in East Jerusalem have held a tense standoff with Israeli authorities as police arrived to evict them from a disputed property. Several residents of one home in the neighborhood climbed onto the roof of a building on Monday with gas tanks and threatened to set them off if the Jerusalem municipality followed through with the eviction. Residents say they bought the property before 1967 when Israel captured East Jerusalem. The state has argued in court that the family does not have property rights. Novak Djokovic has returned to Serbia after losing his challenge to Australia's immigration minister's decision to cancel his visa. The unvaccinated nine-time and defending champion of the Australian Open left the country after hearing the court's decision. Phil Mercer reports from Melbourne.
Novak Djokovic's supporters believe he's been unfairly treated by Australia after arriving in Melbourne last week. They said his deportation was inhumane and outrageous after the Chief Justice of the Federal Court of Australia, James Allsop, rejected Djokovic's last-ditch attempt to remain in the country.
The orders of the court are, one, the amended application be dismissed with costs, two, reasons to be published at a later date. Those are the orders of the court.
The Serbian tennis player was granted a medical waiver from Australia's COVID-19 vaccination rules by two independent health panels set up by the Victoria State Government and Australian tennis authorities. Djokovic had been infected with the virus in December. However, his visa was cancelled when he arrived at Melbourne Airport January 5 by Border Force officials, who said he'd flouted immigration rules. He was sent to an immigration detention hotel in Melbourne. His visa was reinstated by an Australian judge on Monday, but it was revoked for a second time by Immigration Minister Alex Hawke on Friday. Djokovic isn't inoculated against COVID-19, and Hawke asserted that his presence in Australia would stir anti-vaccination sentiment and cancelled his visa on health and public interest grounds. The tennis champion's lawyers insisted the government's argument was irrational and illogical. The three federal court judges unanimously disagreed, and Djokovic's appeal Sunday was dismissed. Victoria State Premier Daniel Andrews said the Australian Open will not be diminished by the Serbian player's absence.
This Grand Slam tournament, one of the big four, is much bigger than any one person. Much bigger. That's why it's a Grand Slam. That's why it's the biggest thing in tennis in the first quarter of every year.
Djokovic has won the Australian Open title nine times. Had he triumphed at this year's tournament, he would have become the most successful men's Grand Slam champion with 21 titles. Before he left Australia, he said in a statement that he was extremely disappointed with the court ruling, but he respected the decision and would cooperate with the relevant authorities in relation to my departure from the country. Phil Mercer for VOA News, Melbourne.
This is VOA News.
This is Science in a Minute.
NASA and NOAA, the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, have each released their independent global temperature analysis for 2021. Both reports indicate that the past year continues a planet-warming trend that has made the last 8 years the warmest since records were first kept in 1880. While not as warm as the previous 2 years, 2021 was still tied with 2018 as the sixth highest temperature on record. According to the two reports, the global temperature for the past year was 0.84 degrees Celsius higher than the 20th century average and about 1.1 degrees Celsius above the late 19th century. The previous NASA analysis for 2020 showed that the temperature increase tied with the record high set in 2016. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
This has been International Edition on the Voice of America. On behalf of managing editor Kate Dawson, producer Nadia Taha, and the entire production team, thanks so much for being here. For pictures, stories, videos, and more, follow VOA News on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. I'm Carol Van Damme in Washington.